I think in my head it was all over. I'm not going to do this. And I looked at my wife and I looked at Tim, and we'd previously spoken about who would make the decision about to pull the attempt. And to be honest, I think I was trying to persuade them to stop. It's really hard to say that now, but you can't imagine how your brain's going to work after 36 hours of riding or whatever it was. I just didn't want to be doing that anymore at that moment. I managed to persuade Tim, but Helen's made of very stern stuff. She said, "You can still do this." And I believed her, but I just didn't want to do it for 11 hours. That was the thing.
This is Explore by the Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa.
What do you mean? It's not. I mean, this is how all these races started. Milan San Remo, I mean...
Yeah, it's true. Very true, actually. I'd not really thought of it like that.
A century and a bit ago, there'd have been an Italian Hannah Troup pouring cold water on the idea. That's ridiculous. No one's going to cycle from Milan to San Remo.
And they bloody did, didn't they?
They bloody did. And they do it every year.
Science in sport. Fueled by science.
You're listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. I'm Lionel Burney and I'm with Hannah Troup. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Lionel.
Well, we've only done about an hour's worth of cycling today. We're not going to be breaking any records, are we?
No, definitely not.
Well, in the last episode, I made a point about how so much of cycling is about doing something because it's there. Riding across Australia because there's a western point and an eastern point. And this episode of Explore really boils that down to its purest essence, because we're going to be talking to Michael Broadwith, who set a new Land's End to John O'Groats record, breaking the 17-year-old record previously held by Gethin Butler by almost 40 minutes. He rode the length of Great Britain from the tip of Cornwall to the top of Scotland in 43 hours, 25 minutes and 13 seconds. That's an average speed of 19.4 miles an hour, which is some going.
What's that in kilometres per hour?
That is 31.2 kilometres an hour. Are we going to have the miles kilometre debate? Because I suspect I'm probably on your side here, because I think everything should be measured in kilometres.
I definitely think that in cycling, that's the game, isn't it? That's what we should be measuring it in.
You're right, but this record dates back to 1886, when miles were very much the currency of cycling. This is arguably the blue ribboned event when it comes to record-breaking cycling in Britain. Only 11 people since 1886 have broken this record. So it's no mean feat. And Gethin Butler's record stood for 17 years, as I say, and at one point was thought to be unbreakable, mainly because so much can go wrong on a record attempt like this. The weather, the wind direction. But I think over the last 17 years, there have been a lot of technological advances. We know an awful lot more about nutrition strategies. And so when I sat down with Michael Broadwith to talk about his record attempt, I wanted to know, how much planning and preparation had gone into it. And I was absolutely staggered. This has been a year or more in the making, quite an undertaking. But at its core, the whole thing about riding from Land's End to John O'Groats is because they are the two furthest points away from one another. It makes perfect sense. There's a kind of a poetry to the record attempt, but he boiled it down to the maths of it because he's a math teacher, as was Gethin Butler. Isn't that incredible? The two most recent record holders, both math teachers. So kind of a combination of science and art for me, this one.
And I have one question, actually. Does it have to go on the same route to break the record? So you can change your route?
That is a very good question. The other question I had was, do you have to go Land's End to John O'Groats, or can you go John O'Groats to Land's End?
Don't want to go that way, though, because then you're going into the prevailing wind, aren't you?
Oh, you've spoiled our little mini package from Tom Wally. Let's hear all about Land's End to John O'Groats, or Le Jog.
Thanks, Lionel. Yeah, there are a lot of rules and regulations when it comes to the Le Jog record attempt. Mike does a great job of covering some of them, but I want to go through a few more of them and some of the records as well. So the rules are very strict, as you'd expect, particularly regarding support vehicles and assistance. For example, nothing can be handed up from a support car, so there's no receiving a bottle or a bit of a feed. If you want that stuff, you have to stop. Pacing is strictly forbidden as well. And the number of times support vehicles can even pass the rider is restricted, which Mike talks about in the interview. There are records for men, women, solo riders, tandems, tricycles, and mixed tandems too. Now, the first formal end-to-end attempt on a bike, this is brilliant. This was by a guy called George Pilkington Mills, and he did it on a penny farthing in 1886. When he was just 18 years old, it took him 121 hours and 45 minutes. Interestingly, 5 years later, he went on to win the first edition of the Bordeaux Paris race, so he was a decent cyclist. The first rider to go under 3 days was Tom Peck. He did it in 1908. He took 70 hours and 42 minutes. One of the reasons why the record is so prestigious is that it's only been set 11 times. At times it's been really popular, other times it's gone unchallenged. It was broken twice, for instance, in 1958 by Dave Keeler and then Reg Randall, brilliant name, and he was the first man to go under 50 hours. There were two attempts in 1982 as well. The second of these was by a 45-year-old John Woodburn, did it in 45 hours and 3 minutes, and he was the subject of Ray Pascoe's film 2 Days and 2 Nights. Woodburn's record stood for a full 8 years until 1990, when Andy Wilkinson broke it by just 57 seconds. Can you imagine the final few kilometres knowing it was that touch and go, whether you got it? Amazing stuff. That in turn stood 11 years, that record, until Gethin Butler, who we'll hear from in this episode. He did it in 44 hours and 4 minutes. And then Mike Broadwith took more than half an hour off that record, taking 43 hours, 24 minutes and 13 seconds at an astonishing average speed of almost 19.5 miles an hour. Now, Mike's not the only person to have attempted the record this year. It's seemingly another one of those years where it's a very popular record to go for. Ian Two abandoned around halfway into his first attempt in May and then tried again in September, but he abandoned again. And also in September, and this is one that I followed as a dot watcher, Jasmine Muller, she attempted it, but she abandoned her attempt to beat Lynn Taylor's 2002 record.
I was a cross-country runner at school. Once I realised I wasn't going to be any good at rugby or football, mainly due to a lack of coordination. And I was a passable cross-country runner, but nothing special. And then I went to university and found myself rowing. Spent 3 years rowing at university, which I really enjoyed, and started to get an idea of what I might be able to achieve with some proper training. My name's Michael Broadwith. This summer, I broke the Road Records Association end-to-end record, riding from Land's End to John O'Groats in a time of 43 hours, 25 minutes and 13 seconds. On the way, I also broke the Road Records Association 24-hour record, riding 507 miles. And this is me talking about it. When I left university, my parents bought me a bike as a graduation present, and I took it down to Welling Wheelers, which was a local club, and got into track racing originally, but realised that I'm not a quick enough sprinter to do particularly well at track racing, and so ended up moving towards time trialling. And I think as time went on, the distances got longer, and I realised that I was better equipped perhaps to, you know, racing longer distances. I think probably my best year was 2006. I got some really good results nationally in 2006. But then after that, my wife and I decided to take a career break and went travelling for a year. And I kind of spent a few years away from racing seriously, and then got back into it again in about 2013, just over the last few years. Firstly, got back into riding 12-hour events, and then someone suggested that I should have a go at the National 24-hour. So I rode the National 24-hour in 2015 and did really well, which was I was really pleased with. And I guess off the back of that was when people started saying, you know, as a 24-hour rider, you should think about looking at the end-to-end. Something I'd always been aware of, but never in my wildest dreams imagined that I would be able to have a serious go at it. And even off the back of a good 24-hour, still lacked a lot of confidence in terms of thinking that it was viable, but managed to kind of back up the 24-hour ride of 2015 with another couple of really good rides that I was really pleased with, and was aware then that I had a support crew who knew what they were doing and believed in me, which was amazing. And I think I reached the point where I just thought, well, I know now that there are so many people telling me I should try and do this, that even if I don't manage it, I won't be looked upon as that it was silly to have a go. And I reached the point where I thought, well, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And you have those decision points in your life where you think, well, in the end, I need to try.
This series of Explore is sponsored by The Economist magazine, which is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts, and even sport. The Economist helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. If you'd like to get a print copy of The Economist delivered to you in the UK, just text the word cycle to 78070. This week, Hannah, a story that caught my eye is about podcasting and the Serial podcast in particular, which was something of a phenomenon when it started a few years back with a really compelling true crime story. But the article looks at how Serial have shifted in the types of story that they're telling. And it also focuses on the strength of audio when it comes to long-form storytelling, which I think we're kind of finding out while we're making this series of Explore, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Serial podcast was what reinvigorated my interest into podcasts. And since that, I listened to that first series, I've been listening to them pretty much every day, as well as obviously, yes, making this series with you as well, Lionel. So it's something that it's been, I think, a bit of a change of process for you as well, that making a series, which is something that I think we've both really enjoyed, hasn't it?
It is, yeah. And I must admit, you know, it's quite a boost to see The Economist writing about podcasting. It kind of lends a sort of authority and legitimacy to the medium when a publication as sort of long-standing as The Economist is taking note. And they do have their own podcast as well, which, you know, true to form, takes an in-depth look at one particular story, and it's a kind of complement to their written coverage. So The Economist also producing their own podcast. But if you would like to get a free print copy of The Economist delivered to your house, text the word cycle, C-Y-C-L-E, to 78070.
I suppose I had read into it, over the last few years, when I was at university, as a way of staying in touch with my two best friends from school, we rode from London to John O'Groats, just the three of us, as a kind of social trip. That took 3 weeks, and we visited a good number of hostelries on the way and a couple of seedy nightclubs. But I kind of remember sitting with them at John O'Groats and just mulling over what it would be like to come back and do the ride more quickly. But I hadn't started bike racing at the time. So I was aware of the journey, I suppose, then. And then I was lucky enough to be competing in time trials in the early 2000s, when there was a lot of coverage in the comic about the characters of the time. I guess I started time trialing in 2001, which was when Gethin set the records, and it got a lot of coverage in cycling at the time. So I read that. And it was really exciting, it being broken by someone who I had raced against. And I suppose that sowed a seed, really. Not that at that time I'd ever considered it was something that I would have a go at myself, but it certainly was something that caught the imagination.
So you must have thought it was breakable.
Do you mean when I set off in 2018? Well, my friend Tim Bailey from Arctic is a numbers man, and you know, he'd run the numbers through various algorithms and websites and so forth, and I guess on paper it was breakable. But the big unknown is, you know, as anyone who's gone for this record knows, it's one thing to do something for 24 hours, but no one knows how they'll be affected by that second day, and more importantly, I suppose, that second night. And it's all very well to say, you know, if your power output's this or you can keep on at this speed, then you've got a chance of breaking it. But for everyone, once you get past that 24-hour point, it's a journey into the unknown. So, yeah, I suppose I knew that if the conditions were good and if my body was able to cope with the second day, then at least on paper I would have a chance. But the reality, I guess, is a long way from that.
So for those who don't know, who are the custodians of the end-to-end record, and what are the kind of the mechanics of actually formally stating that you want to make an attempt on it?
So the end-to-end record is one of the records that's looked after, I suppose, by the Road Records Association, which is an organisation that's been around since the kind of late 1800s. The record in its present guise has been around since the 1920s. Before that, it had a time as a paced record, and then a time when there were some ferries allowed en route, but the all-land unpaced record dates to the 1920s. It's a very traditional organisation, and they're fastidious about making sure that the rules that you use for your record are the same as the rules that have always been followed. This means things like making sure that you have an official observer in each of the cars that's following you, that your following cars only pass you at intervals of half an hour or so, and various other bits and pieces. The way they run things, you need to submit a schedule of what time you will start at Land's End, and then approximately what time you would anticipate being at various waypoints along the way. And then they send out an army of volunteers who will leap out of hedges at the occasional, at different occasions, just to see that you are following the rules and see where you are. And in order to kind of get that group of volunteers mobilized, you need to give them 48 hours notice. So you specify a day when you might go, i.e. the first possible day, but you don't need to go on that day. You can then wait until weather conditions look favorable, and then you give them 48 hours notice. So I guess it meant a lot of time sat at work when I should have been working, looking at various weather and wind websites to see when that dream weather day was going to arrive.
What are the rules in terms of the route? I mean, do you have to go Land's End to John O'Groats? What route can you take?
No, the all of the RRA place-to-place records can be set in either direction. So you can choose Land's End to John O'Groats or the other way around. Because of the prevailing winds, the enormous majority of records have been set from Land's End to John O'Groats. In fact, I believe, although John Taylor would be the one to consult on this, that David Duffield's trike record is the only record that's ever been set from John O'Groats to Land's End. I have to say, for a couple of reasons, we only ever considered the Land's End to John O'Groats way. I think that if you and most of your team is based near London, it's much easier to get to Land's End. And also, I think the fact that John Woodburn, Andy Wilkinson and Gethin had all done Land's End to John O'Groats, I was keen to make sure that my ride stood up in comparison to theirs as directly as possible.
So once you decided you were going to do it, and you basically put the RRA on notice, was there any kind of buzz around it? You know, did you feel like you awakened some kind of beast?
Yeah, it's strange to describe, really. I suppose it's like we were very, very uncertain about the day. We'd been waiting for a long time, and then within the support crew, which numbered approximately 16 people, there was a kind of subcommittee who would decide whether we went with the weather conditions, and that was me, my wife Helen, Tim Bailey, and then my friend Rob, who was actually one of the guys who came on that Land's End John O'Groats trip 20 years ago. And we looked at the weather data and they weren't sure, and it was my call in the end, and I was very nervous because I knew just how much people would be giving up to allow me to kind of go on this journey and how much it meant to all of us. So it's a big call. And I still remember being at work on the phone to Helen, and she basically said, look, if you're sure, then we should go. And I had this sudden certainty that I can't really describe, and said, you know what, that's it, yeah, we will go. And at that point that you say we will go, and that was on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, I can't remember, and we're starting on the Friday morning, you've kind of started this process then that you can't stop. And it's like being on a conveyor belt that you'll never be able to get off until you get right to the end. So yeah, it was a case of all the people who'd been waiting on tenterhooks for the previous couple of months, who'd thought that it was never actually going to happen, were suddenly very excited and wanted to say hello or wanted to wish me luck. And I was having to kind of consciously put my phone away or stop looking at my emails, because I had to focus then on getting myself ready for the biggest race I ever had to do, whilst also trying to support Helen, who was trying to pull together a support crew at 48 hours notice and get them down to Land's End, which, as you can imagine, is a logistical challenge.
Rafa, adventure starts anywhere.
Rafa sponsor the cycling podcast all year round, as well as this series of Explore, of course. And if you're thinking of going off on your bike for an adventure at any point in the next few months, you might want to check out Rafa's waterproof frame pack, which was in fact used by James Hayden on his way to victory in the Transcontinental race. If you've not listened to episode 1 of Explore, that features James Hayden talking about winning the TCR back-to-back years. And if you've seen any pictures online of James on his way to victory, you'll notice the waterproof frame pack by Rafa tucked neatly under the top tube on his bike. It's a durable waterproof pack designed to fit inside the frame, but with easy access on the fly. It's made of a hard-wearing PU-coated ripstop polyester fabric. It's waterproof, engineered in-house, and tested to destruction all over the world. So if that sounds like the sort of thing you need to put all your stuff in when you're going off on a bikepacking adventure, check out rafa.cc. Tell me about the support team and how that all worked.
So the support team was drawn almost entirely from my family and friends, and people who'd been interested in the event that we'd kind of tapped up from February, really. On the road, it consisted of four vehicles. The first was the Arctic van, as it was christened, which belongs to the manager of my cycling team, who runs an air conditioning company. That had in it him and a co-driver, along with Tim Bailey, who was running the kind of mechanical support. Steve Abraham, noted long distance rider, and then a cycling writer called Paul Jones, who came along for some of the journey, and also an observer, John Williams from the RRA, who runs the Mersey Roads 24 hour each year. So they kind of were my direct following car for most of the journey. They carried the spare bikes, spare wheels, all of that kind of equipment. Then our car came along, which had in it a friend of mine called Dave, who drove almost non-stop for 43 hours. Ian Boone, who is again a RRA observer and one half of the Boones, which we shall come back to in a moment. My friend Rich, who was on the historic journey to Land's End. And my wife Helen, who was coordinating the whole support crew, along with our, at the time, 8-month-old daughter Poppy, who was unable to be away from Helen for too long, so by default had to come along as well. As well as that, we had the timekeeper's car. My timekeeper was a legend of the London North time trial district, a chap called John Pick, who's been timing events on the F1 since before anyone can remember. We provided a couple of drivers for him, and then he was accompanied with the observer Bridget Boone. Bridget and Ian are very accomplished tandem riders. I think they still have a couple of competition records. Bridget is one of the strongest 24-hour riders ever. She's still got, I think, two or three of the top five or six times distances of all time, so it was a real honour to have her along. And then finally, my aunt and uncle, who've been there to see all of my 24-hour rides, came along in their camper van, along with an exceedingly large chest of fancy dresses. So I kind of went from Land's End to John O'Groats, accompanied at various times by Buzz Lightyear, a dancing star, a unicorn, an angel, and various other characters I can't remember. But they're brilliant, brilliant couple who are kind of unfailing, not only in their support, but their good humour.
In terms of the morale versus pressure, how much did having that entourage of people kind of weigh on you, or once you got on the road, did that kind of all melt into the background?
Honestly, it was incredible. I think I just felt very, very lucky. My strongest memory from Land's End was that we got there about an hour before we were due to start, like you would if you were doing a time trial or something like that, and they were all so busy and so focused. And in fact, ironically, I was the one who didn't really have anything to do, so I was just sat on a bench listening to some music and watching them and just thinking, my goodness, I know with absolute certainty that I couldn't be here with a better team and a more dedicated team. And I suppose it gives you a real inner confidence, because you think, look, I've got all of these people who know so much about this event and so much about what they're doing, and they're all here because they believe that I've got a chance of breaking this record. And, you know, for all of my worries beforehand that I wasn't going to be considered a credible contender, I suppose that evaporated then, because I thought, you know what, if this lot believe in me, then I must have something of the right chance to go for it. So yeah, no, it was nothing but an incredible encouragement to know that they were all willing me on.
How do you go about pacing the effort? I mean, what the first 2 hours, 6 hours, you know, 10 hours, you're a quarter of a way in, I guess. But what was the strategy, and how do you, you know, how much detail do you looked at the numbers?
It's strange, isn't it? I suppose I kind of, again, like anyone really, I was going into it fairly blind. I think my working was, I know I can race for 24 hours and I know what that feels like, but when you finish a 24 hour, you're lying on the ground knowing that you don't have to do anything else, and you're being ferried home by someone and you're spending a week recovering. And I had to change my mindset from finishing 24 hours totally spent to finishing 24 hours essentially in good enough condition to then go on and do a good 20 hour race, which even as I say it now sounds completely ridiculous. In terms of how to approach it, what I was most conscious of, and to be honest, in all of my long distance racing, I've always reflected on something which a chap called Nick Gardner told me a long time ago about 12 hours, which was, you just absolutely totally have to avoid any kind of power spike, because any damage that you do to yourself, even in the smallest power spike, will come back and hit you 10 times over. And I think I assumed that, being as it was a 43-hour race, 42-hour, 44-hour, something like that, then that effect was going to be completely magnified. So really, I was going into it thinking, well, in the first 5 or 6 hours or 10 hours or whatever you want to say, I've just got to concentrate on keeping the power down on the hills. And so each of those hills I got to, I was meticulously spinning up them, to the extent that my observers were worried, because they thought that I was in a, you know, I was unable to climb and it was all going to be a problem later on. I think Helen was trying to reassure them that it was all part of the plan. And I was freewheeling most of the descents, because I just had to try and keep as much left in the tank as possible. It's interesting, Gethin set a very high bar for the 24-hour, RRA 24-hour record of about 505 miles, and our schedule didn't have that. I think we scheduled for about 499, because we were very conscious about not wanting to get stretched into going too fast too quickly. As it was, because of the tailwind, we did pick up the 24-hour record just, which was good, but it certainly wasn't on our kind of list of A targets. Just because we just wanted to try and minimise that damage from going too hard.
What was the magic number that you were trying to avoid going over?
I don't want to kind of bore people with power numbers and so forth, but when I've raced 24 hours, I've always tried to restrict myself to 300 watts on the hills. And so dialing it back a bit for this, I wasn't going over 280. So I was sitting on all of the climbs on the A30 and really all the way to Shap as well. I went up Shap at 280. I was just sat on 280 on the climbs, knowing that that was well within what I was able to sustain.
And in terms of plotting your way, the route is all already set before you go, but how do you know where you're going?
Well, I last February, during half term, I went away and I rode a substantial portion of the route as a kind of recce. I think I planned at least a fairly final draft of the route by last Christmas. And so then during February, I took a train down to Taunton and I rode the section from Taunton to the Midlands one day of half term, and then I took another train up to Kendal and I rode from Kendal all the way up to Perth over 2 days. really just with the aim of understanding where the tricky junctions were and what the general feel of the route was. And I have to say that made an enormous difference, because I think once the chips were down and I was tired, just having that kind of memory of individual corners or individual points on the route is, more than anything, it's just reassuring. I'm not saying that I would have got lost if I hadn't have done that, but actually it lends a positivity to the whole thing, because you have that comforting feeling of roads that you know. As it is, I'm a bit of a maps geek and I have a fairly good sense of direction, so I didn't get lost at any point, or I wasn't worried about the route at any point. I kind of knew where I was going, but it was certainly of huge benefit to have ridden the trickier bits beforehand.
Do you know how much your route differed from Gethin's, or how much of it was the same?
No, I don't. I think most routes are pretty much the same as far as Bristol. There's a little bit of a debate about which way to get through Bristol. I know that Ian and Yasmin, who went this year, went a different way through Bristol, but I just went through the town centre. And then from Bristol really up to about Warrington, you've got two choices. Some people tend to stick closer to the Welsh border, which I think is a little bit lumpier and a little bit further, but avoids the town centres. If you stick closer to the Midlands and head towards Stoke-on-Trent, it's flatter, faster, but it does go through a couple of town centres. And I guess it's a case of, you know, you take your choice and see what comes your way. I was all about just trying to keep the distance down, really. And I figured that at least any delays that I encountered are mini recoveries. And I just wanted to get, I knew I could get that distance to about 8:40. And that sounded like a good plan to keep that down. Once you get to Warrington, again, the route pretty much writes itself. There aren't that many choices beyond, you know, very small diversions through Perth and things like that.
Did you go wrong at all? Did you have any technical hiccups?
No, I mean, I didn't go wrong. I think I went round one roundabout twice because I was a little bit confused about the exits, but that was about it. In terms of technical hiccups, we had a few Garmin issues in the Midlands. Still not quite sure what happened. I think one of the support crew, I'm going to blame them, managed to switch the Garmin so that it was trying to run the route backwards. I don't know what function that is, but anyway, we changed Garmin and their Garmin was just constantly telling me to turn around, which, although I knew the right way, was going to be quite annoying for the next 7 hours. So we kind of swapped it out for another Garmin. But no, the technical issues were fairly low-key, really. You know, I think we'd done quite a lot of research about what equipment we wanted and how we wanted to play it, and it all went pretty well.
Did you hear from Gethin before the record attempt?
Well, I gave him a call to tell him that I was going to go for it, really, and, you know, just to catch up. And he was, as always, an absolute gentleman. And he then called Helen back with a couple of bits of information about the route, saying how he was concerned because he knew that there was a bridge closed in Lancaster and he wanted to make sure that I knew that. So no, he was fantastic. And then as I've mentioned elsewhere, he then turned up en route, which was brilliant. It was lovely to see him, and I was, you know, absolutely, it sounds a bit over the top, but absolutely honoured, really, that he considered coming out to support for as long as he did, and to climb Shap and to see him, you know, in the mist on the top of Shap at 4 a.m. cheering me on was something that gives me goosebumps now just thinking about it. You know, I can't ever thank him enough for his support in me going for this record, and it meant that the whole event meant even more to all of us who were involved. It was fantastic.
Hello.
Hi, Gethin.
Yes. we're obviously very sad people, aren't we? Teachers, bike riders, I like going out and wearing ourselves out for long periods of time. I'm Gethin Butler, and I was the previous record holder for the Land's End John O'Groats record. I love maps as well. I like looking at maps, but as far as riding the bike, it's just knowing your body, knowing how hard you're going, I suppose. I mean, I suppose theoretically there were heart rate monitors around, but I think if you'd been riding for a fair amount of time, you knew how hard you were going. I mean, by the time you've ridden a few 24s and a couple of 12s, you know roughly how hard it should feel when you're going at a point that you can maintain your power output, which obviously Michael had, can help you, I think, on hills, because obviously Michael's a bit bigger than I am, so he's taking a bit more weight up the hills, so he might have to think more about how hard he's trying up a hill relative to what I did. But I had to work on this simple premise that if it was hurting, I was going too hard. That, in the end, is just learning your body.
Science in sport. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
We'd have a you know, several big mountain stages throughout the three tours, and it could be anything from the double Stelvio ascent, which you're going to be climbing for a long time. And that there is really, really vitally important that you fuel appropriately. Hi, my name's Hayden Groves. I rode all three Grand Tours last year in 2017. Yeah, that's the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France, and Vuelta a España, a total distance of just over 10,400 kilometres. Not only did I do that, I'm also an ambassador for Science in Sport, and at the same time, I raised over £100,000 for the charity Cure Leukemia. Myself personally, I would follow the pros approach if it was a long, hard climb, and I would have almost like a single shot of a caffeine gel, so about 75 milligrams, about 20 minutes before the climb would start, and would certainly look at a gel every 20 minutes. And that's where they come into their own, because you just reach in the back pocket, have a bite, squeeze it, and obviously we would not leave litter on the climb, so that would just go beating in the back pocket. That's not the time that you want to take your cheese and ham baguette when you're climbing and climb like the Stelvio.
Thank you to Science in Sport. If you would like to get 25% off all Science in Sport products, go to their website, scienceinsport.com, and when you check out, enter the code SISCP25. Can you pinpoint the moment you thought it was in the bag and that you were going to break the record?
Yeah, I think I can. I think we had such a torrid time in the Highlands, going up Dromochta in particular. You know, my neck was in real trouble, and I guess more than I was just worried about how much worse it was going to get, and I'd had a total loss of confidence. And then as we came through the Highlands and the weather started to clear and a bit of blue sky appeared, and there's a lovely descent off the Highlands into Inverness, you know, eight or 9 kilometres, and as we did that, the sun came out and the support crew had laid on a pit stop just by the Keswick Bridge, which is the kind of main road that bypasses Inverness. And I remember coming into that and seeing my brother who'd flown up from London, and just seeing the faces of the support crew and the weather, and I guess just mentally getting onto the finishing circuit, knowing that, you know what, you cross the Keswick Bridge and you see that first sign for John O'Groats, I think it's John O'Groats, 120 miles, and just suddenly thinking, you know what, this is within reach. And you start doing the maths and you're working out the hours, and you're like, actually at the start I had to do this many miles an hour, but now I'm here and I'm past Inverness and the miles an hour is just getting smaller and smaller and more possible. And so I'd say, yeah, from crossing the Keswick Bridge, I felt a lot more positive. To say it was in the bag would be silly, because it was still a fairly tough 120 miles, but I certainly had got that positive frame of mind in place, and I was smiling inside.
What were the physical consequences of doing this ride? You mentioned your neck. What was the problem, and what were the other symptoms that you were suffering?
The physical side of things was, I guess, part of the adventure. The neck thing totally took me by surprise, and it came on very quickly. I just kind of lost the ability to hold my neck up looking forwards whilst kind of in a low position on the bike. So I changed bikes to a less aggressive setup. I had a second time trial bike with the handlebars about 5 centimetres higher, and I managed to at least get myself a position on there where I could see the road. I was finding it hard to look any further ahead than 20 or 30 metres, but I was able to lift my head for short periods of time to check road signs and things like that. So, you know, it's not ideal, but I was able to get by. The only other real physical issue that I had was I seemed to sustain some nerve damage in my left hand just in the last 3 or 4 hours. It was weird. When I was cycling along, I felt like I had that feeling where you, like if you've been at a snowball fight and then you put your hand into hot water and it really hurts. I had that on my left hand and I couldn't really work out why. I kept asking the support crew for another glove and then putting it on, and then it didn't get better and I was throwing the glove off again. But I didn't really think about it until after the event. But having seen videos of myself now after the event, I'm just clasping my left hand into my armpit trying to warm it up, and it was really, really painful. I think it was nerve damage. It seems to have mainly recovered now, but we're talking now a significant period of time after the event, so I don't know what it was, and the doctor was unable to shed any light on that. In terms of physically cycling wise, my legs felt okay-ish a week or two afterwards, but from those people who saw me at the Mersey Roads 24-hour, which was 5 weeks later, they all confirmed that they weren't, that whilst the legs were okay, they weren't quite back to their normal self.
And lastly, I mean, talk about how your relationship with your wife went through the ups and downs in this 43 hours. I mean, she was running the logistics, really, running the support crew, and I guess was the first port of call every time you stopped, every time you had a moment's doubt.
She was totally incredible. I guess I knew beforehand that she was totally incredible, but to see her go through what she went through is something that, you know, just blows my mind, and it blew the mind of everyone who was on the support crew. And I had no idea whilst I was doing the event just how much she was interacting with the outside world in terms of running a Twitter feed, answering to queries, staying on top of everything, and then also communicating with the rest of the support crew, taking on board what their needs were, what their questions were, and then also not only monitoring what I was up to, supporting me, but also watching me go through some incredibly dark moments. It must have been very difficult. It was very difficult. And then she was there at that very lowest moment, halfway up Dromochta, and we had a fairly intense conversation. And if it weren't for her, I know with absolute certainty, I would not have completed this event. It was her words, and just her words, that got me back on my bike and got me going again. And I know that she'll have said those things and got back in the car and cried, because she was worried about the consequences of her persuading me to keep going. So yeah, no, an incredibly deep and stressful and emotional moment, but something that I'm so proud that we did together, and I wouldn't swap it for anything. I think the fact that the two of us conceived of this plan together and researched this plan together and put this plan into action and succeeded in this event together is something that I feel very, very lucky to have been part of.
What was the problem? I mean, were you on the verge of giving up, and what was it she said that persuaded you to keep going?
I was more than on the verge of giving up. I had given up. I think my neck was very weak. I couldn't look forwards, and I was just sick of being rained on. I just so bored of cycling in the rain. And that sounds like I'm very soft as I say that, and maybe I am, I don't know, but I just, the best way I can describe it was that the fire that normally burns inside on a race, you know, when you're doing a time trial or anything like that, even in a 24 hour, there's always that kind of internal fire burning, and it was all fine until, you know, we got to Edinburgh and I was starting to feel very tired and very wet, and then every time we changed clothes, I was just getting wet again. and we got through Perth, and I got a bit of a head of steam through Perth, and then you've just got this long, long climb, and as I was going up that climb, the fire just kind of was getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and I just reached this point where the fire I thought had gone out, and I just didn't want to be there anymore. I didn't care, and all I knew was it wasn't that I wanted to be warm or anything, I just wanted to stop doing what I was doing. And they bundled me in the van, and I was desperately trying to convince Tim and Helen that it was time to stop and I'd had enough, and they were having none of it, and I couldn't really understand why they were having none of it. I was thinking these ridiculous thoughts like, oh, it'd be much better to stop now because we're near Perth and it'll be easier to get a hotel for the support crew or something like that. You know, stuff that was just completely irrelevant to what we were doing, but I'd just lost the context of what we were doing. And Helen looked to me and she said, you know, you need to keep going. I believe in you and I believe you'll get through this tough patch. You know, your legs are still fine. Your legs are still good. We've just got to get through this. And I remember looking at her thinking, I just don't want to do this for another 11 hours, you know. And so she just seized on that and she said, well, look, you know, forget about the 11 hours. Do you think you can do it for another 20 minutes? And I remember this kind of, I think that must have been the moment that she just kind of, you know, the fire just somehow, it was the indignation perhaps of course I can do it for 20 minutes. And so she just said, well, you know, off you go, we'll do it for 20 minutes and we'll have a chat in 20 minutes. And in that 20 minutes, the fire came back almost totally. You know, I remember vividly, there's a contraflow on the A9, and I was cycling through that contraflow just thinking, I feel much better now. I don't know why, I don't know how, where that's come about. And, you know, maybe she's the only person that could have turned that around, but luckily she was there and she did. So that's how grateful I'll be for what she said, because that moment was the crux of absolutely everything. Every race I've ever done, every training session I've ever done, everything planning for this event came down to that single conversation in a nondescript lay-by by the side of the A9 in the pissing rain.
Wasn't there somebody who'd said anyone can make it to Perth and all this was happening at Perth?
Yeah, I think it was Woodburn who said any fool can get to Perth. And I think, yeah, maybe you're right. I think perhaps it's strange because you inevitably have Perth in your mind as a real serious staging post, because apart from Inverness, I guess it's the last big town, and you go right through the centre of Perth and you go past Perth Station and you come out the other side and there's a big industrial estate and an Asda and all of this stuff, and then you symbolically leave civilization behind and you go off into the Highlands, and you know you've got this enormous climb up to Dromochta, but more than that, the scenery changes and it becomes more dramatic and darker and all of this, and you go from that elation of reaching Perth to this sudden realization that you've still got whatever 190 or 200 miles left and still a good 50% of the elevation or something like that. You know, what's still in front of you is enormous and you're absolutely totally exhausted. And so I can see where that comes from, because maybe like people say you hit the wall in the marathon at 22 miles or whatever it is, then perhaps really when you get to Perth and you think you've done so much, you're only really halfway.
Records are there to be broken, and it was good to see it go eventually. It's one of those things, your half of you hopes it doesn't get broken, the other half wants to see things progress, so yeah, bittersweet, I suppose. As you go for these records, you must think that there's a good chance you're going to get it. I mean, obviously you prepare for it. I mean, mentally I knew I was about as well prepared as I was going to be. I was obviously relatively quick. I like going long distances, so the combination's great. I suppose ideal, realistically, for that sort of thing. Obviously, Wilco's record had stood for 10 years at the time anyway, 10, 11 years. Things change, roads change, machinery changes. It's just the law of improving things, I suppose.
I mean, your conditions weren't ideal, were they? Just talk me briefly through what your ride was actually like.
It started okay. I mean, obviously, you set off when you've got, hopefully, a reasonably good tailwind, which I did have all across the southwest of England, got up into the Midlands, and when it was dark, because I was in September, so it got dark relatively early. I think just outside of Bristol I put lights on. By the time you got up to Newcastle, under Lyme and stuff, at the tops of the hills, you were getting light mist, fog sort of thing, but it wasn't too bad. Got to my hometown of Preston, and it started to rain there, so only a little bit, but enough to annoy. But hey, that's life. Everybody gets a bit, most people get rain, so you put up with it. Shap, which is about halfway, it was absolute thick fog over the top there. There were people out cheering. It was about, I don't know what time, 4 o'clock in the morning or a bit before that, but someone took a picture. You could hardly see anybody. It was that thick. But after that, it wasn't too bad. I think the next thing I really remember, apart from obviously the 24-hour mark around Betock, was up the Devil's Elbow or whatever it is, out of Moffat, and that was, there was water running down the side of the road, so it was obviously raining up there. Stopped at the top just after the 24-hour, got changed, dried out. After that, I think it was just because it was damp, it was hard to get going again, but you do. At Pennycook, I needed a short break, so I had a 10-minute kip, got going again, felt okay. My wife would tell you I went into tourist mode, so you were riding, but you weren't really, should we say, completely with it. You were just plodding along, trying to find any excuse to stop. And then second night came along, and I really seemed to pick up then, by which time you were sort of up near Perth, or beyond Perth. But once I got over the door knock first, the last 80 miles was absolutely thick fog. You couldn't see anything. Wind was howling off the sea. When you went inland, you had a tailwind. When you came back to the coast, you had a headwind. The car that was behind couldn't see anything apart from my lights. I didn't know I'd got to Berrydale. I'd finished climbing Helmsdale till I hit the descent on Berrydale. It was that thick of fog. You've had a job to do. You just got on and you just did it. I think by the time I got to John O'Groats, I actually felt fairly fresh, if you can say that. I think the difficulty of the conditions up there just added adrenaline.
So at what point did you know you'd done it on the approach to John O'Groats and the critical roundabout?
I think I felt very positive from Inverness. Had its ups and downs, both metaphorically and literally, and I know that my support. I have since read the group chat that they were having at the time, and they were far less certain. But they didn't quite know what my legs were like, and they knew that there were some very stiff climbs coming up, Helmsdale and Berrydale. But I was looking forward to them, and I think I'd always dreamt. I mean, literally, visualised and dreamt what it would feel like to be climbing up Berrydale, knowing that you were going to break this record. It's such an iconic location, and there's some amazing photos of like Dave Keeler in the 50s walking his bike up Berrydale. And I came down the hill into Berrydale village, and I just looked on Google Earth or whatever and the bend, and I knew where it was, and we talked about how the support crew were going to be by the roadside, and Helen was right in the village. And I shouted out to her, "Is this Berrydale?" And she, I can't remember what she said. Yeah, it is, and you're going to do this. And my aunt and uncle were on the switchback bend, just cheering like mad. And then my friends were just running alongside, and Rich, who's another of the guys I rode from Land's End to John O'Groats with, was there running alongside and just shouting. It's like 2 a.m. and he's been up for 36 hours. But the intensity of that spectacle was incredible. And to be, I remember thinking, I mean, I must have gone up that climb, I don't know, because 400 watts, who knows? It was just, I was climbing as well as I've ever climbed, and I'd been on the bike for so long. And at that moment, I was just thinking, you know, this is me right here with my friends and my family climbing this iconic climb, and I'm going to break this record, and it's amazing. And from that moment, part of me was wanting to finish, but then part of me wasn't wanting it to finish. I was riding along thinking, I need to enjoy every second of this because it's incredible, and it will be with me for the rest of my life.
So now that you've lowered the record, in a way, do you feel like you've kind of re-energized the Land's End to John O'Groats? Because for such a long time, people thought, well, Gethin Butler's record might not necessarily be unbreakable, of course, but it was a considerable mark. And in the time that's elapsed since then, you know, bikes have improved, nutrition has improved, and also the tools available to people have significantly advanced in terms of, you know, you can understand a lot more about power distribution, you can measure power outputs a lot more. Do you feel like you've kind of maybe put it on the radar for some other people? Do you anticipate anyone else having a go?
Well, I hope so. And I'm sure I have. I think, you know, like anyone who's involved in time trialing, times continue to fall. Every year people are like, will they really carry on getting faster? And they do keep going faster. I think, you know, it was possible to look at the 20, you know, like you, and people who are interested will say, well, okay, Gethin could do this for 24 hours and he set the record, the end-to-end at this level. But then you read about Gethin's ride, you think, well, okay, he had this problem and this problem. So now people will look at my 24-hour distances and think, well, okay, Mike did these distances, but he had, you know, the rain and all of these problems, and he still did this time. Well, I know in my head I could have done this time, and people will just continue to do the comparisons and do the maths. And, you know, Andy was a brilliant 24-hour rider, and he did these fantastic distances. I came along, I'm nowhere near the rider Andy is, but I've managed to do really good distances. And then this year Andy Jackson's done a really good distance at 24 hours. And so people, more and more people, will go over 5:20 or will go over 5:30, and eventually someone will go over 5:40 again. Eventually someone will ride 5:50 for 24 hours. And if they've ridden 5:50 for 24 hours, then they'll take my end-to-end record to pieces. So it's a continual process. But I think the challenge is that a 10-mile time trial, you can keep going out and having a go week in, week out. Even a 12-hour, you could have a couple of goes in a year. A 24-hour is only once a year opportunity, so you've really got to get it right on the day. And the end-to-end is even more like that, because although you can pick when you go, the financial constraints and the emotional constraints and the logistics of getting a team together are such that you have to really put all your eggs in this basket and all commit to it. And so it's such a prohibitive effort to enter that becomes the kind of guiding principle, I guess.
And lastly, would you ever do it again?
I'm taking a very deliberate pause here. I think I'm keenly aware of the impact that it's had on everyone around me, and it would need to be a very carefully thought out decision. I would love to have another go at the 24 hour first and do a really good ride in that, but never say never. And I think, I know we could have done it faster, and there would be an advantage in going for it without having the pressure to have to go for it. So I think putting yourself in a position where you can go if the conditions are good, but you don't have to go because you already have the record, would be a strong position to be in. But equally, I'm not saying that will happen. It's something we can talk about in 6 months' time when the dust has settled.
Michael Broadwith's achievement is obviously very impressive, but how does it compare to the sort of racing that the World Tour professionals do? I spoke to Alex Dowsett of Katusha, a British time trial champion, of course, held the hour record on the track until Bradley Wiggins broke it. He also won a long, by World Tour standards anyway, time trial at the Giro d'Italia a few years ago. And I spoke to him just after he'd completed the Red Bull time lapse, which was a 25-hour endurance event, a team event, 25 hours because it took place on the night that the clocks went back. I wanted to get a sense from Dowsett of whether this kind of record is something that a World Tour rider could even envisage tackling.
It's huge. I followed it the whole time. He had a tracker, an online tracker, so you could see exactly how he was doing throughout. I actually used to, when I was a junior, I used to race against Michael, well, in track league and time trials, so I know him quite well. It was quite entertaining watching, because I think there was another guy going for it as well, sort of at a similar time, and referred to Michael as being quite heavy. And that ended up being a kind of running joke in Michael's attempt. So it was nice to see a jovial approach to it as well, as it being obviously being really quite serious. And phenomenal achievement, just that amount of hours on a bike. And you know, see, like, obviously in the latter stages, when Michael's neck started suffering, and yet people just clubbing together and bringing in like neck supports for him and going and supporting out on the road. No, it's just, it's the side of, it's what cycling's about. It was so good to see. I think I was racing at the time, and I'd start a stage and I'd just check, and then when I finished the stage, I'd check again to see how he was getting on. I mean, how you prepare for something like that is beyond me. The only thing I can liken it to, the hour record, right? We never did an hour because of how much it kind of ruins you. So I can, with Michael, I can't imagine he would do, like, if I was preparing for it, I wouldn't want to do like 300 mile rides as preparation because of how long that take to recover from. But you have to do some sort of, you sort of try and focus on pushing up your threshold so that, instead of riding 1,000 miles, say 800 seems easy, riding at 25 mile an hour, so 19 mile an hour seems slow, stuff like that. And I guess the nutrition side of things would have been crucial, because once you start blowing, it's really tough to come back from that.
So that record attempt, and successful record attempt as it turned out to be, turned you into a dot watcher?
Oh yeah, well, I'm a numbers guy anyway. I mean, I was a numbers guy long before Michael went for the end to end. I think it's a time trial and an hour record thing.
And what do you make of the kind of the rise of the sort of bikepacking, the unsupported events, things like the Transcontinental, things where people are out on the road, not just for hours and hours at a time, but days at a time?
I think it's utterly mad, but utterly brilliant. I think anyone in the World Tour would very much struggle to do the stuff that these guys do, because it's so different to what we do. Maybe social media really has brought it to the fore as well, because it's so... You can see it. You can see what these guys are doing now. Guys and girls, sorry. With things like the Transcontinental, it's all documented. There's pictures, there's videos, there's it's YouTube, Instagram, Twitter. Everything's so documented that other people can see how epic it is. And I think a lot of people at some point in their lives want to go and do something epic, whether it be ride the London 100 or London Marathon, run the London Marathon, or really challenge themselves. And this is the epitome of challenge, so it's quite inspiring as well.
Does it spark something in you? I mean, you're obviously challenging yourself every day of your pro career, but have you got an eye on the sort of the middle distance? I mean, could you imagine yourself doing something like Conor Dunn and Larry Warbass did, or Thomas De Gendt and Tim Wellens did? Have you got a kind of a bucket list of cycling challenges, sort of homemade cycling challenges, maybe?
I'm starting to think about that a little bit, just doing something more than just sort of trying to lift my FTP. There's certainly in the World Tour, there's things I still aspire to win and achieve, and like the hour record is the obvious one there, is that is still very much a goal in my mind, and it's kind of similar, but it's very different, but also quite similar to stuff like the Transcontinental, because it's a challenge of quite an epic proportion, albeit it's substantially shorter. It's a different kind of suffering, but it's I guess it's a similar kind of mentality. I chatted with Nathan Haas at Worlds when we were there for the team time trial, and we started talking and looking at the tandem end-to-end record and what we could do there, because obviously we're talking about numbers that are completely probably overestimating our ability to ride from one end of the country to the other and what it actually takes. I guess these things start with a joking chat over a couple of beers, saying, oh, we should have a crack at that, and then next minute you've signed up to it.
So we just need to get a few more beers inside you, and you and Nathan Haas can tackle the tandem record. It's on the record now.
Yeah, I don't need many beers, mate, that's for sure. I'll be on the floor quite quickly. But yeah, it's e-cycling is, it's, you see with EF Education, like the sort of direction of that team has changed slightly, and the rise of gravel races, and can you say like cycling sort of diversifying a little bit into more than just racing, and starting to really think outside the box in terms of what we're competing in or what we're racing against.
As I said to Michael in our interview, by breaking the record, I think he's put it back on the radar, and I wouldn't be surprised if more people want to take it on next year and the year after, because he brought it bang up to date. And what's really interesting is that he considered it to be a long time trial, not a short bikepacking event. It really is a time trial. It's a race. It isn't an adventure.
And, well, I mean, that's quite incredible that he actually looked at it in that way. I definitely think I would be putting that under a bike ride of type 2 fun.
Bike rides of type 2 fun. What's a Gran Fondo? Is that type 1 fun or type 2 fun, or is that type 1.5 fun?
It depends on how you ride it. So we're going to talk to Chloe Hoskin, obviously, and I was in Italy, in Verona, earlier this year to ride a Gran Fondo for the first time ever. And I've ridden my fair share of sportifs, some of the Belgian race things, couple races and like Paris-Roubaix and everything. And I had never realized what a Gran Fondo was actually going to be like. In, we were there, and because we were there as press, we were there almost at the front of the whole of the group of riders. I literally remember looking over my shoulder behind me, there'd been rows of people and just a lot of gurning people ready to the gun to go and to just fire off. And it shocked me. I was a little bit taken aback by just how crazy it felt.
So it felt like being on the start line of a race rather than just a nice day out on the bike.
Yeah, for the first few kilometres, it's literally everyone weaving in and out, cutting in front of you, riding from both sides, over both sides of you, overtaking you. And I was just up for taking it as a type 1 type of event that day, potentially even thinking about having a glass of wine at the top of the climb, which they'd give out. But there's definitely a lot of people that are not in that place. And I remember getting to the top of the first climb and I had to lower my saddle. And I asked one of the mechanics who was there to do it, and he started fumbling around. He dropped the screw out of the bike seat, out of the seat post, and he was really panicking. And he said, "Are you in a rush?" And I was like, "No, no, no, it's fine. Calm down." I don't know what is tranquillo in Italian, but I was like, "It's fine, it's fine."
Well, the Gran Fondo scene is almost like a semi-pro, and in some cases, professional category of racing, isn't it? A lot of ex-pros take part. They've had their troubles with doping scandals in Gran Fondos. It's really taken very seriously. A lot of sponsorship money floating around. It's almost like a sort of an offshoot of professional cycling itself.
And you're saying that about the doping side of things. So Gran Fondo New York, which is a popular organisation that does a lot of Gran Fondos, they actually do doping testing now as part of their racing on some of them. I think in their world championships that they have.
Yeah, because it's prestigious. If you win one of these events, you can make a name for yourself. It's a serious old world. And, well, we're going to hear from Chloe Hosking, who races in proper races. I'm going to get in trouble here, aren't I? It's categorising proper races as proper races and Gran Fondos as Gran Fondos. I think that's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when we say proper races, she races at the World Tour level for the women's peloton, so, and rides for Ali Cipollini. So yeah, a very good sprinter.
The first time I spoke to her was on the Champs-Élysées after she'd won La Course in Paris a couple of years ago. She's the current road race Commonwealth Games champion as well. And, well, she was riding a Gran Fondo in Italy. But why was she doing it?
So the Gran Fondo was the Le Merx Cipollini, or the Le Merx Alain. Oh, I've totally fluffed that. Anyway, it was a Gran Fondo in Italy. It had some relevance to LA and some reference to Eddie Merckx. And she was riding it, and she had taken her boyfriend along, and it was the first time that he was ever going to ride one. And she was trying to be kind of supportive and get him through his first Gran Fondo.
Am I reading between the lines correctly to say that there might have been a little bit of tension in this arrangement?
Well, because she was on the front row, because obviously she was part of the pros who had been invited to it, and her boyfriend was a couple of rows back, maybe only five. I think she'd pulled up in the first 500 metres to wait for him. I was like, what the hell's taking you slow? Why have you only got hit now? What have you been doing? And I think it's just this mad dash that had completely blown his mind a little bit.
Well, let's hear from Chloe Hosking talking about her Gran Fondo experience.
It was a bit of a stage process. Like, my partner sort of found out about this Gran Fondo, but coming from Australia, like, we don't really have Gran Fondos, so he didn't really, I think, sort of grasp the concept of it. And then the morning we were driving to the Gran Fondo / race, Fortunato, our director, said there's 2,000 people starting. It's not just a casual bunch ride with your mates on a Saturday or Sunday morning. It's a huge group of people, and probably I think the first 200 to 300 people are really trying to race it. So I think from actually my experience, there's sort of two ways you can do it. You can race it, or you can just decide before you start, I'm just going to chill out, you know, enjoy the scenery, stop at the stops, yeah, just take it for what it is. So when the gun went, you know, I come into it with a race mentality. You know, as soon as the gun goes, you go and you fight for position. But obviously my partner, he hasn't raced, so he doesn't have that mentality, and I think he sort of did think it was just going to start like, you know, your normal Sunday bunch ride with your mates. And then so as I've sprinted off, I look behind me and I can see all the people that were there to race starting to form, and there's already like a group of 20 going off the front, and I'm like looking behind me waiting for my partner to come, and he wasn't that far behind me. He must have been like three rows behind, and honestly I think 100+ people passed me before I saw him, and he's sort of just like, you know, bobbing along, and I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I got stuck behind with these three old guys. And I said, get on my wheel. And so then, like, you know, raced him back up to the front. And so he, in terms of a babysitter, I think he had a pretty good one. I think the number one tip would be make sure you know the course. Because, yeah, my partner and I, like, you know, I had him positioned and we were probably like top 30, but then we like hit a hill that we didn't know was coming, and we also didn't know how long it was. So I, like, for sure, if you're planning on racing it, study the race book and make sure you know, like, when a hill is coming, how long it is, and these sorts of things. A second tip would be, there is so many people, so you don't need to stress about being on the front at the very beginning. It's, you know, another saying I grew up with is, you know, you need to be near the front but not on the front. So to conserve your energy and then sort of take it from there. I think it's great to do it with a friend, you know. Like, while I gave my boyfriend a hard time, it was really fun sort of moving with him through the peloton and having a buddy to get through it, and then also obviously push each other, you know. And I I kept him honest. I said, you know, I'm disappointed you didn't try harder, and he knew as well, so off he goes. And then I did probably the second half by myself, and it would have been really nice to have company, but Yeah, I think my teammates had the right idea by chilling out a little bit, well, a lot further back, because the reality is with 2,000 people, I'm not sure how long the peloton is. It must be, I don't know, 10 kilometres long, if not longer. So, you know, if you do lose your mate, you're probably not going to find them again. I had a woman come up to me, and I feel like she might have been like the Grand Fondo world champion. And she said something to me in Italian, and I made no attempt to understand what she was saying. But I feel like she was a bit threatened that there was another woman around, but I didn't stick around for long. As I said, I didn't realize there was a hill coming. Well, it was actually hilarious. So as I said, he chuffed off after I guilt tripped him, and then I didn't know if he'd done the short or the long. And then I warmed down a little bit, and then I turned around to see if I could see anybody that I knew. And then I just see this guy standing in the sun, shoes off, shirt off, just chilling out. And it was my boyfriend. I'm like, oh, you cheated. You did the short one. He's like, yep. And I killed it. So he was pretty chuffed with himself. He told me that he found like a group of about 15 to ride with to the finish, and I think he finished about 6 minutes down on the winner, even though he decided mid-race that he wasn't going to race. In the end, he still had a performance that he could take some pride from. So that was, you know, I think that we actually, it was a fantastic day. You know, I said to some of the girls afterwards, it was the most fun I've had on a bike in a long time, you know, just without the pressure and having Jack to sort of, you know, look after. And then we went down to the Rizzo party afterwards, and that was just a fantastic atmosphere. You have to take your hat off to Verona. Just nobody cared. There were bikes everywhere. And they're all like, yep, no worries. go ahead. And it was super straightforward to get back down. You know, we must have finished about 3K out of town or something, but it was not an issue at all to get back down there. And then also, you know, they had thought of everything. They had the bike parking, and it was just like a flawless transition from the, you know, you got your beer, and then you got your cheese, and then then you got your crostatas, and then your rice. And it was really like, turned it from a good experience into a great experience, in my opinion.
Hannah, it feels like quite an adrenaline pumped episode of Explore, this one. Takes me back to my days as a third and fourth cat racer at Hillingdon Cycle Circuit. It's exactly the same as a Grand Fondo, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I think that the certain mentality of certain people who take it very seriously, it can be. I think the thing with Chloe and what she was saying with her boyfriend is, if you're not used to riding that closely and with people around you that are going to or losing their minds a little bit, it can feel incredibly off-putting. So I think it's about, you have to kind of decide what is it that you want to get out of that day. Is it that you want to actually go and be competitive and go a bit elbow to elbow? Then if that's the case, get yourself to the front, because that is exactly what it will be like. But if you want to have a day where you, like me, get to the top of a climb, look at and like eat some nice melon, maybe have a little bit of a glass of red wine, which they often have on the continent in those kind of races or those kind of events, then just know to position yourself at the back, because otherwise it will be not the nicest of experiences.
Can I just point out that where I position myself is often not optional?
Well, I mean, it's always optional at the start. You can always put yourself right on the start line lineup, and then you'll find yourself out the back quite quickly, which is fine. But it's definitely a certain breed.
Yeah, my troubles start when the pedals start turning. That's the big problem when it comes to these kind of events. But we're going to have a real gear change in episode 4 of Explore. There'll be no racing talk at all. So until then, Hannah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
Next time on Explore.
I cycled to the nearest airport, got a flight back to Scotland, sold all my stuff in car boot sales. I bought a £300 city bike, loaded it up, all the wrong equipment, and off I went. But I just followed my heart, and it's turned out to be the best thing I've ever done.
Ned bolting there, dancing away on the pedals in that inimitable style, in his trademark flat-soled suede cycling shoes, hovering just above his brook saddle, England flag fluttering in the breeze. That's why they call him the flag bearer of Bedford.
You've been listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. The producer was Tom Wally. Music in this episode, including our opening theme, Beyond the Black Veil, is by Moscow Youth Cult. Their latest album, Brutalist, is out now on Hello Thor Records. You can find it via hellothor.bandcamp.com. This episode also featured additional music by John Dix.